Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. Jesus used miracles to teach lessons, and his greatest lesson involved Lazarus. First, he allowed a sick friend to die. Then he raised him from the dead to show that he is indeed the resurrection and the life. From the Moody Church in Chicago, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Erwin Lutzer is finishing his series on seven convincing miracles. Today we turn again to John chapter 11 for a message on Jesus, Lord of Death. As he teaches his disciples, Christ is now on the way to the grave of Lazarus.
Now notice that Jesus likens death to sleep, and many people, because they've interpreted it wrongly, they think that the soul sleeps until the resurrection of the body. Well, we know that the soul goes directly to God. It is the body that sleeps in the grave until the day of resurrection, not the soul that sleeps. And so the Apostle Paul can say that I have a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. But I want you to notice the text here. Jesus said in verse 14, I am glad that I was not there so that you might believe. We may say, well, that seems contradictory. Here are Martha and Mary weeping, and Jesus, who loved them, is glad. Here is Lazarus in the tomb, and Jesus is glad. Here are the disciples, distraught because of going back to Jerusalem meant perhaps certain death for them, and Jesus Christ is glad. Well, of course, Christ isn't glad because of the sorrow, but he is glad because of what the sorrow does in our lives. Spurgeon said, oh, blessed axe of sorrow that cuts a pathway to my God by chopping down the tall trees of human comfort. It is in our sorrows that we sometimes see the glory of God in ways that we never see on those pleasant, happy days that all of us would like to have. Now Jesus goes back. And you've heard me speak on this passage before because I like to emphasize the if-onlys that the disciples, or I should say that Martha and Mary, give to Christ. Verse 21, as Jesus is going back, Martha, who I believe was the firstborn since she has firstborn characteristics, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Wasn't that beautiful? If you had been here, but now, even at this point, you could still do a miracle. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? I need to ask you today, do you believe this? I'm glad that some of you do. The front row seems to. You believe this? And then Jesus comes a little closer to their home, and by then Mary is reached with the news, and Mary comes. And you'll notice she says in verse 32, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not have died. The sisters were saying, Jesus, you have to be here physically or else my brother is going to die, and you weren't here, and so he's dead. But I want you to notice those if-onlys. If only you had been here. Of course, Jesus could have spoken the word in the Transjordan, and Lazarus would have lived, but the sisters, bless them, are thinking that Christ had to be physically present. If only. Have you ever attended a funeral where there weren't at least some if-onlys? Sometimes there may not be any, but oftentimes there are many if-onlys. A widow said to me, if only I could have gotten him to the doctor sooner. Somebody else says, if only he had had surgery, then he might have lived. Somebody else says, if only he would not have had surgery, he would have lived. Somebody says, if only we'd have gotten the cancer sooner. If only, then we know that God's will would be done. But now somehow God's will has slipped through our fingers because the if-onlys were not in place. What you have to do, my friend, is to take a circle, and in that circle put all of your if-onlys and call the circle the providence of God. Oh, but you say, Pastor, it isn't that simple. I know someone who was killed and a drunk killed them because he drove over the median and hit the car. Now, you're not telling me that the drunk was part of God's will. The drunk didn't wake up in the morning and say, oh, God, I give myself to you today and I want to do your will. He was doing his own thing. He was in the wrong. And now look what happened. My child is dead because of him. I believed for a long time that one of the reasons it sometimes is difficult for Christians to accept whatever God gives them is because our view of providence is not totally, completely biblical. Of course the drunk should be punished. But the drunk, in doing that, did something that was known by God. God could have had him begin a minute earlier or a minute later. He could have had that accident happen somewhere else to somebody else, or not at all, because God is in charge. The best illustration is one that I gave last Sunday night, where I'm speaking on a series of messages on providence. Here's a person who hates his neighbor and says, you know, my neighbor has all of these lovely trees and he loves these trees and I don't like him, and so I'm going to do him ill. So the man gets up early, late one night, and he crawls over the wall and he chops down one of these trees and says, look at the damage I'm going to do. And he does it, and the tree is lying there on the ground. The next morning, the man to whom the trees belong is going for a walk with his carpenter, and they walk along a trail, and he says to the carpenter, do you see this tree here that's lying down? He says, it is my intention to employ you to build a garage. And notice very carefully, I marked this tree. It has a special mark on it because that's the one I wanted to have felled to use for the lumber. Isn't it wonderful that somebody has come last night and already done much of the work for me? That's the way it is. Now, the person who crawls over the fence and does it has to be punished. Absolutely. But he still did what actually turned out to be something that was beneficial to the man. And that's the way the devil always is. And that's the way drunks are on our highways, too. They have to be punished. They are fully responsible. But that indeed may be the chariot that God would use to take one of his children to heaven. Because that's what death is. It's a chariot that God sends. You go to the Drake Hotel, and they have 24-hour-a-day valet service there. And they are always ready to let you in. Jesus Christ has that too, and he escorts us from this life to the next. And he does it in so many different ways. Isn't death creative? Just walk through a funeral home sometime and then ask yourself the question, what caused this person to die? What caused that person to die? Always different causes, but death is the means by which we get to God. So we die within God's providential will. God is bigger than our circumstances, as the Willis family learned a few years ago when, what was it, 6 of their 8 children were killed in that tragic accident. And after the accident happened, he turned to his wife, Janet, and said, this is the reason for which we are prepared. We're able to accept this because God is bigger than our view of providence. So the believer dies not only within the context of Christ's love, but he also dies within the context of Christ's control or providence. He also dies within the context of Christ's power. Now in verse 23, Jesus Christ said, your brother shall rise again. Martha said, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And then Jesus made that marvelous statement that I read just a moment ago. And finally, Jesus comes to the tomb in verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved. You know that the Greek text actually says that he was outraged. This is a very, very strong word that is used. What would Jesus Christ be outraged about? At the whole idea of death, that in this fallen world people have to go through death, that could be a part of it because he is touched with the feelings of our infirmities. In fact, verse 35 says, Jesus wept. Maybe it is also because of the way in which the people were weeping and mourning. They may have been weeping and mourning like those who have no hope, like the pagans. Some of those who came along with Martha and Mary might have been wailing like that. And Jesus would have thought to himself, now that's totally out of place, because this is a believer. He's going to live again. Even if he didn't live right now, he will live again at the resurrection in the last day. This is not the end. Paul says, we do not sorrow as those who have no hope. And so Jesus here, there was an involuntary groan that came from deep within him as he comes to the tomb. And he himself weeps, but he weeps silently because he knows that there's a resurrection that is about to come. So Christ comes to the tomb, and then he says to them, take ye away the stone. But Martha, verse 39, the sister of the dead man, said, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there already for 4 days. He's been there for 4 days. Now, what Martha is really saying, and she's trying to be polite, is simply this: Lord, it's too late. It's too late. If you had been here, my brother had not died. But now, 4 days. Why was 4 days so important? Why did Jesus stay away to make it 4 days? You know, in Jewish tradition, there was a myth that sometimes the human spirit hovered around the body for 3 days, hoping to get back into the body. And then after that period of time, the spirit went on to wherever. And then there was absolutely no chance that the corpse could ever live again. And maybe what Jesus was doing is trying to put up such barriers to a resurrection that no one would have an explanation for what he was going to do, except for the fact that he did it, that he was God, and that this was a grand, glorious miracle. This is Pastor Lutzer. As someone who has studied some philosophy, I've read some of the best theologians on the problem of evil. In other words, how do we reconcile the fact that God is sovereign and good with the reality of sin and suffering and the terrible things that are taking place in our world? And I've discovered that there is really no good, satisfying intellectual explanation. At the end of the day, it is our hearts that tell us that indeed God does care. And I suppose that there's no place in all the scripture where we see it more clearly than Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus. We've learned that Jesus groaned and that Jesus wept. Today I'm speaking to someone who's going through a severe trial, heartache that is really the kind that cannot even be put into words. And you're asking this question. You don't understand all of the issues and all the philosophical aspects. What you want to know is a simple question. Does Jesus really care? And the answer is yes. Like that hymn says, oh yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. Here's Jesus at the tomb of a friend, reminding us that as man, he was weeping, but as God, capable of doing a miracle.
Thank you, Dr. Lutzer. Today, Erwin Lutzer brought part two of Jesus, Lord of Death, his final message on the 7 convincing miracles found in the Gospel of John. Next time, join us for the conclusion. This series can be yours on CD as our thank you when you give a gift of any amount to support Running to Win. Just call us at 1-800-215-5001. That's 1-800-215-5001. On the internet, go to offerrtw.com or write to Running to Win, Moody Church, 1635 North LaSalle Boulevard, Chicago, Illinois, 60614. Ask about 7 convincing miracles when you write or call. For Dr. Erwin Lutzer, this is Dave McAllister. Running to Win is a ministry of the Moody Church.